Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge, and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed. However, today is going to be a special episode. I'm joined by the person who's always sitting next to me on the couch as we record these things. It's Juliana, my girlfriend. Say hello.
Hello.
And we're going to be talking about not a book. Although we will talk about a book, not a series of books, but a series of interpretations of a single story. So this is the Ender's Stuff podcast. I was going to say it's the Ender's Game podcast, but we're not going to be just talking about Ender's Game because, you know, I've done an episode, even though it's a weird episode. You know, Ender's Game is a very well-known story. It's a classic. There's a movie out about it and things like that, you know, that came out, which is kind of why we're doing this podcast. But what we decided to do is actually talk about the different interpretations and the different retellings of the basic Ender's Game story. So, warning up front, if you don't know the main story, the story of Ender's Game, go away and read the book and come back and then listen to the rest of this. We're not going to spoil other retellings, but go away, read the original story. Even if you don't like it, it's worth reading as a historical science fiction, not historical, like a historically important book. You know, it won the Hugo Award and the Nebula Award, and it's worth reading, you know, just it's part of modern science fiction literature.
Yeah.
If you don't know the book, you can't be part of the wider conversation, I guess is one way you could say it. Not just about this, but in science fiction in general. Carry on.
And it has good, really, really good, fun new ideas to me. And it's, I really enjoyed it.
Okay. Well, so from now on, let's set off the spoiler warning. The spoiler horn, whatever. That's what they do on the Incomparable podcast. They go, so it's a big fog horn in the background to know, here be spoilers. So let's get into it. First of all, you were saying, let's talk about the original book. Oh, yeah. So what we're going to do is we're going to do the book, the original book. We're going to then do Ender's Shadow, which came out in, 2001 or something? When did it come out?
2002.
First published 1998. Yeah. So that came out in 1998, which is like a retelling or partially a retelling of that story. And I read that years ago, probably not long after it came out anyway. And you just finished it just a few days ago, Juliana.
Exactly. I read it as a German ebook.
German ebook. Then we'll talk about the audio drama, the audio play version of Ender's Game called Ender's Game Alive, which was released last year as a kind of a tie-in to the movie. And then we'll talk about the movie, which came out last year and we watched a few weeks ago on Blu-ray at home. We didn't go to the cinema. We were thinking, oh, let's go to the cinema to watch it. And then we heard early reports saying, probably best not bother with the cinema, watch it on Blu-ray. So we did, or DVD. So we watched it later. Saved ourselves a lot of money. And went to watch The Hobbit instead. So, accidentally in IMAX. So, let's get on with this.
You told that story before?
Yeah, did I? I can't remember. So, but accidentally seeing something in IMAX instead of normal is really good if it's The Hobbit. I wouldn't have wanted to do it with other movies. But, hey, let's get on with this then. So, the Ender's Game. We don't need to spend too much on this one because it's a very well-known book. But what were your impressions? When did you first read it? It was a few years ago, wasn't it?
It was in 2011 or 2012.
I think it was one of those times when you were like, hey, what science fiction book should I read?
Exactly. And first of all, we went into a bookshop, in a German normal bookshop, and I've asked for that book, and they have quite a... they had a young adult science fiction section there, but they it was out of print. And so...
In German.
In German, yeah. And so we didn't get it in as a paper book, but so then I got it as an audiobook.
Yeah.
And I think I listened to it as an English audiobook because I remember the narrator always saying the third, and yeah. I didn't understand what's going on. The third. And later on, of course, I figure out that it means he was the third born.
He was the spare kid.
In that family.
Yeah.
But it took me quite a while because at the beginning you always talk about the third.
Yeah.
And I listened to it while working on the computer doing spreadsheet stuff. So
your last job when you were an Excel monkey.
And I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed the idea, the basic idea of of the whole story. To have aliens attacking the Earth.
Yeah.
The aliens behave quite a bit like an Independence Day.
Yes.
And then take kids, because if you go to space, you have to be young to to be then, when you reach the place where the aliens are, still be in a good age to...
Well, it's a bit weird because that's not really made clear in the book. You know, they're saying, oh, we've got this Ansible, which is going to, you know, we can communicate over long distances and things. But there is that kind of thing where they go with Maser Rackham, the old general,
yeah,
who the old war hero. And I quite like the idea that they send him out at almost light speed and then bring him back. So relativity plays a part. So he's still alive.
He's still not that old.
Even like 80 years later after the last attack, it's still like, oh yes, but he's still around. It's like, well, how can he still be around? Ah, relativity is your friend.
Yeah. Awesome. No, but the general idea of training children by making them play games, which is just in general how humans work. Like how humans as animals do work. We learn something by playing.
Yeah.
And of course, kids do learn by playing as well.
Well, you see it with kittens and things
and
like that.
And yeah, playing is the way to go. And it's really funny because in my studies, we talk a lot about the word playing an instrument and stuff. You play something.
Well, you play the piano.
You play the piano. You play the violin. It doesn't say like in English and in German. In other languages, it didn't work so well. But still, you play to learn something, to get better. And so you take kids, you teach them something by them playing games among each other. And then later on say, yeah, you will be trained to become officers and stuff.
Mm.
Turns out...
That is the thing. Yeah.
And I really enjoyed the twist because I didn't...
You didn't see it coming.
I didn't see it coming from the beginning. No, but it was quite clear because Ender is actually quite clever. So he...
But he doesn't work it out, though.
He does not really work it out, no. Just when he's in the last battle, he sees, okay...
Does he? I'm not even sure then. I think he only notices when he turns around and all the commanders are cheering and stuff.
It's like they say, hey guys, this is the last test in your school.
Yeah.
And
by that time he's got all his friends around him all being sub-commanders and things.
Yes, exactly. So, and then he turns around and all the generals and all the adults suddenly like really like cheering and like happy and stuff. And then he suddenly realized, oh no, it wasn't a game. I was commanding a real army and stuff.
And I think this is the reason why it's like, even if you don't like the message of it or the themes of it, or you know,
or even how it is done,
that it's such a like you say, those two ideas of getting children to like, they think they're playing games, but it's actually real, and then the big twist that it's not just the games. A real training, but actually the game is real as well.
It's
a one-to-one correlation between that and reality. That, even if it's not a twist, and I think it works, even though it's not a twist, like we'll talk about probably later on when we get to these retellings, you know, which people already know the big twist.
Yeah.
And do they work? Like, if you already know the big twist, does Ender's Shadow work? Or does Ender's Game, the movie, work? I still work. And I still think, they can still work, because it's not just about the twist. Even though it is a twist that I would never want to take away from anyone. Yeah, I released a podcast last week about spoilers with me and Jesse that started from an argument. Well, not even an argument, him having an undefensible position and me getting quite passionate about it. But it's like, why would you ever take away that experience from anyone of the twist at the end of Ender's Game?
It's like an important twist, and it's a good twist.
But why would you ever read the book again if the book was completely reliant on that twist? Why would you read the book a second time or third time?
Because it has so many layers in it, and many things that you can discover. It's not only about the twist.
No,
but
it's not about the twist. But I think conceptually the book works.
Yes, of course. If you know the twist in advance, if you know in advance, oh, and they're playing the game, which is not a game.
Yeah.
It would take away a lot of surprise and and enjoyment of the cleverness of the author.
Yeah, like, but also I think, like I say, even if that same story was written by someone who couldn't write as well, you know, because sometimes I think his writing is a little bit clunky. And also the character of Ender, I think, is quite unpleasant in the situation that he's put in. Like, morally, it's very ambiguous. Like,
oh yeah, even if you don't like
that whole setup and you disagree with it politically and you don't like Ender as a person because, you know, he's self-righteous and whiny, but not whiny, but always gets through and always wins out. I know it's a book about somebody who always wins out because that's what he has to be. You know, is the story because they've been breeding him for they've been breeding these kids for generations, you know, yes. And like genetically modifying people, as we know with these other stories as well. You know, it's all of these stuff is set up, you know, this whole school has been put in place to find this guy, to find Ender, to take the war to the Formix or to the buggers or whatever they want to call them.
Yeah, that's true.
But like I say, even if you don't like all of those aspects, I think the story itself is one of those classic stories. It's like a fairy tale. It's like a modern fairy tale in a way. Like, this story could be retold, and it is, like I say, by Orson Scott Card and these other things. It could be retold over and over again, and the story, like the basic story itself, still holds firm, still holds strong.
It's really strong, yeah. What I also think is that the story is also saying, if you, as an adult, have a problem, take it as much as a child as possible to get as much creativity in your solution as possible. Because having a problem and solving it in an adult way is often just how was it done before? What can I take of that? But no, kids are just, they try out things and they try out again and they fail and they try and they fail again. And I think this is also a big part of the story is about to tell people, hey, be a bit more like children when you have a problem.
That's a really good point, actually. And I can definitely apply that to my own, like, I can see that applying to my own life, actually. You know, when I try stuff and, you know, like, oh, I'll just do it the same way as before. You know, I'll just do it the same way as before. But yeah, it's actually the best solutions are when I just, not try something random, but like when I just play around with the ideas.
Exactly, that is it. Play around. This is the whole thing.
Through play.
Playing makes your mind open for other things, for things that you wouldn't expect, and you would combine things that might not seem to fit together, but in the end turns out to be a good idea.
But I disagree with you that this is a book like that. You say it's about, oh, try something, it could fail. Ender never fails. There is never a failure from Ender. I mean, there are a few tiny failures. That's what I actually quite liked more in the book. No, in the movie, there was that scene, you know, when they get to the end and he's in, not in battle school, but in command school.
Yeah.
And he actually fails one of the tests. Do you remember it? Like, there's actually a moment where he fails and he was like, oh, well, I just need to, you know, I just need to move on and I'll do better next time. They were like, you took your eye off the ball, you failed. He's like, oh, next time I won't fail. And they're like, well, you better not fail. In the book, I don't think that happens. I don't think there is in the Ender's Game book. He doesn't have that moment of failure. He just succeeds and succeeds and succeeds. And then through all the way through to the end, and then he succeeds in the last test. Maser Rackham, who is playing the part of the, you know, he's been told that Maser Rackham is playing the part of the Formix, you know, that he's controlling the enemy fleet. Well, actually, in reality, he's not. I think in the book, Maser Rackham never beats him, although it's a while since I've read it. But in the movie, the Formix, the Maser Rackham, you know, that role, he does beat Ender at one point. Ender does take his eye off the ball, and I actually quite like that more in the movie. There's quite a few things in the movie that I like better than in the book. And one of the things is that Ender didn't succeed every single step along the way. There were a few failures. And that's what I don't like about the book in some ways, is like he sets up his new army and wins his first battle and then wins his next battle and then wins his next battle. And there's never a time, like even against these overwhelming odds where he's put up against two different armies and things. Like, of course, in the big battles he should win, but I think it would be better just to show him failing a little bit more.
Okay, let me say something about this failing thing. So first of all, he himself as a person in that society is supposed to be a failure. He is a third kid, not really, like, he was officially, he was, his parents applied for him to be there.
He was a permitted third,
but still he is somebody that other people refer to be a third. Yeah. And second of all, he has this really big psychological troubles. So he is between his brother and his sister. And he's the mix of them. And this is, I think this is his failure in life. It's not, he is in other bits, he's perfect. But he has...
I'm not saying he doesn't. I'm not saying he doesn't have flaws. I'm saying he doesn't have failures.
He has failures. He doesn't fail. There's a big difference.
No, but the thing is, you can have flaws and not fail. That's my point. Is that it's okay? It's okay to have a perfect character who fails quite often, just due to overwhelming odds. And that's what makes the structure of a lot of books interesting. Is that you have that, you know, that crashing point, that low point where the hero has tried everything that they can and they're still being prevailed, and then they've got to pull through. You know, they see that spider manage to swing across the top of the cave or something, and then they go out and lead the armies or win the day or something like that.
Yeah.
And Ender, he has a moment like that when he goes back down to Earth and hangs out with Valentine and sits on a raft, you know.
Yeah.
He sits on a boat in the middle of a lake and he's looking up at the clouds and they're like, no, you've got to get back to it. But at that point, he has self-doubts. He has flaws, like you say. He's got this weird split personality, or these two conflicting sides of his personality, the kind, loving side of Valentine and then the total psychopathic side of, is it Peter, his brother? I think it's Peter. Valentine and Peter. Of those two sides that are conflicting in him. But like I say, he has flaws, but he doesn't have failures.
Yeah, and this is the thing about the Ender's Shadow book. I didn't enjoy it so much at the beginning, but at the end, there's something really fun happening.
Yeah. Well, should we get onto that in a minute?
Yes, but I just wanted to say that one thing in Ender's Shadow is adding to this bit of the story. That Ender is never fail. That Ender is not failing.
Yeah.
And I will say that later. Then.
No. If it's pertinent now to failure, just go for it now.
So when Ender, there's this bit at the end where I really am enjoying the book a lot. It's when Ender is leaving to command school, and Bean and his friends are still in the other school.
Yeah, don't they get put in charge of their own armies, don't they?
Exactly. So, and then Bean gets his own army, and he's losing. He's losing 5 times in a row.
Yeah, because he's overthinking everything.
Before they get transferred to the command school as well. And what he says is that he gets asked about why did you fail, why did you not win, and he said it was not about the winning, it was about learning from your failures. It was learning, it was making the people fail and then learning from what happened when they failed.
Yeah.
And this is a quite important addition to the Ender's story at that point, because as you said, Ender's armies never failed.
Yeah, and that's why he took it in the movie. That's why when he did fail at that point, he took it really hard.
Exactly.
You know?
But he
saying in the movie, he learned something from that failure, which I don't think he ever seemed to do in the book.
No, but the thing is, so he had never had a failure with any of his armies. But the people that were in the armies beforehand, and when they were transferred to command school after him, they had all the experience of failures.
Oh, because Bean made sure that they had those experiences.
So Ender himself, it was important that he never, like in the book, he never had the failure. So he was still strong, and he didn't need to learn from that stuff, I think. But his friends that he also then commanded, they did have the knowledge of failure.
And that's what Bean saw.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So Bean made sure that this all... mix and matched quite well together.
That's a good view of that one. So what else have you got, anything else to say about the book,
Ender's Game?
The Ender's Game. I just do want to say that while I really enjoy the storytelling, it's one of those books which doesn't sit well with me, like I say, because of those political things, you know, I saw here on Wikipedia, as I was just glancing through this Wikipedia page here, it says that, you know, in the critical reception part, let me have a look here. So, nope, I've lost it here. It was good. So yeah, Elaine Radford's review, Hitler, Ender and Hitler, Sympathy for the Superman, posits that Ender Wiggin is an intentional reference by Carr to Adolf Hitler and criticizes the violence in the novel, particularly at the hands of the protagonist. And someone else writes, creating the innocent killer, Ender's game, intention and morality, wherein Kessel states, Ender gets to strike out at enemies and still remain morally clean. Nothing is his fault. And that is one of those weird things that you're going, well, okay, who is the bad guy? Like, who is the, you know, is it the general? What's his name? Graf? General Graf?
Yeah, General Graf.
Yeah, Hiram Graf. Colonel Graf. And it's like, well, is he the one? Because he's the kind of like the mastermind behind this whole thing.
Yeah.
But then I'm thinking, like, is he in charge of the whole fleet? Like, how can, or is he just in charge of finding a commander for the whole fleet? You know, it's one of those things that, like, all of the morality, it's always, you know, it's sort of like mistakes were made. The whole, like, by, it kind of generalizes, well, not generalizes, but it kind of abstracts away any responsibility from every player in the book.
Yeah. I understand this point of view, but also you must. This is also what Card is playing with. They are children, and this is always the question: how responsible are children for their actions? And the thing is, in that book, the children are put in such a high intellectual position that you feel that they are like adults, like they are intelligent as adults. So when Ender is fighting Bonzo Madrid, you think, oh well, he knows what he's doing, he's killing him, he knows that he did it,
but he's not told he kills him,
but he knows it, and but still he is a child. And then you think, how much can you like put children into saying...
But you're making excuses for them again. That's the whole point. You're removing responsibility.
No, I'm not making excuses. I'm saying that this is what Orson Scott Card is playing with. The question, how responsible can children be, even if they're super intelligent?
Yeah, but I also think it's not just about children, though. That's the thing. Like, it's one of those stories that becomes more universal than that. Because it's not just, but like, if they're not responsible, who is responsible?
Exactly. So then are the teachers responsible? The teachers do have a lot of, like, pulling, like,
power,
how do you say, like... Them. Like this strip pulling in the background or something.
They're puppet masters.
Yeah, they're puppet masters. But then you think, well, the Colonel Graf, he could knew in advance what would happen, and they pretty much have a good overview what happens on the station. So then, would you say then that an adult is then responsible for what happened because he didn't interact, and because he didn't intervene? So this is the whole, I think it's lots of things that are into that responsibility.
I understand that, the kind of thing, but I'm just saying that overall, the book never sits well with me. It never, like, just from that kind of, like, view of violence and view, all that kind of stuff. I know it's me because I'm just at heart a pacifist, but like I also feel this. It's one of those things that it grates at me knowing that down below I have a bit of Ender in me with this, striking out. Like I told that story of when it was last summer and stuff with the guy who tried to steal your iPad and I punched him in the face. You know, I know this kind of reaction. Oh, if I deal violence now, immediately I don't have to deal with violence again in the future. You know, that's exactly that kind of thing. And I was like, yeah, but I don't want that. You know, I was like, oh, I want to love them. But then Ender is like, oh no, I love them. And then I understand them because I love them. And then I destroy them. And you're like, no,
it's terrible. And the violence in that book is horrible.
Yeah.
And especially that the children get so like, and the thing is, children are cruel.
Yes.
If you see children play, they get really
cruel.
But
what I don't like, and what I saw here, I mean, I haven't read those reviews, the one about, like, Ender can stay morally perfect and morally clean because nothing is his fault and nothing is his responsibility. But I guess that's why it becomes down to that kind of like a mythic figure, like Jesus stays morally pure and then dies for our sins and takes our sins on. Yeah. Ender does that at the end, you know, he feels responsible and he takes the responsibility and he becomes this figure, this war hero that can't even return to Earth anymore.
Yes.
Because he's then too powerful, like, so then he has to go into the heavens. And I understand that it's playing with these mythical archetypes and it's a Jesus redemption story, but still it kind of makes me cringe, you know, that like as I'm reading it, I'm like, how can this kid who is, like I say, it's like Hitler in training, genocide, you know, yeah. apologist in, oh, not genocide, xenocide is the, I guess, the technical term, which is a name of one of the later books. Like, what, it, you know, what is it to wipe out an entire species? And, yeah. But even then, he gets redemption at the end because there's the egg, you know, he gets the new hive, mother, no, queen, the queen. He gets the queen's egg and he gets a chance at, you know, resurrection of as a person, and the enemy is resurrected and it's everything's kind of set right again. So yeah. you get that whole exploration.
Even when he destroys something and he makes something bad, then it turns out
oh, it'll be fine,
it'll
because
be fine.
I mean, that's what the next book is about, him finding a place to put the queen's egg, the queen bugger Formic's egg. It is one of those things that, like, in the end, oh, and it still becomes, and in the end it's fine, you know, and that's what I kind of don't like about it. And people go, oh, I feel like Ender, and I'm like, ugh. Like there's that moment, like I say, when I feel like Ender, or I feel those kind of tendencies, or feel like, I don't want to say rationalizing things like him, it just makes me feel uncomfortable. But then again, I think that's probably the power of the book. Despite yeah. the weird political views of the author, the book yeah. itself has that power. So, yes.
And this is what makes it reading. So, it is so, yeah, sorry. It is like, it's like this moment when you like something and then it's so cruel that you hate it. And then, but then you think it's all just metaphysical things going on. And then you think, oh, well, that's clever. And then it puts you in this weird position, you as the reader.
What, you're appreciating something that you kind of disagree with or disgusts you, but you're still enjoying it in a way.
Yeah.
And that's one of those weird things that a lot of people say, oh, should we pay for this book because the author is homophobic and is against gay rights and things like that? Or should we watch the movie because money is going towards this homophobic person? And there's all these discussions specifically around Ender's Game. Like, can you still enjoy a work if the person who wrote it you disagree with politically and morally and
this
ethically
is
and
whole
stuff
thing
like that?
With arts and
it's difficult. But you're saying that, like, again, it's that tension. But I find that tension, even if I didn't know who the author was or what he thought about specific political things and what his, you know, religious affiliations were and all that kind of stuff, I would, because when I read this, I didn't know anything about that, but it's still,
I didn't know.
Yeah. It's still got, either. And I read a whole series by Orson Scott Card. I think it's the Homecoming series. I didn't realize it was all an allegory for the forming of the Mormon church, of these people going to this place and going across there.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I read like three or four books into it. The first two books were quite interesting, and then it got really stupid. And I got sequel fatigue and then gave up. But it is one of those kind of things that you read it, and I guess it's like people reading the Chronicles of Narnia and not realizing it's all Christian allegory. You're just like, oh, it's a story with a lion and a lion and a witch and a wardrobe, and there's yeah. kids and stuff like that. And people go, oh, that's Jesus. Oh, like that. And it was one of those kind of things when I was like, oh, that was all Mormonism. And I was like, oh, right. You know, there's, yeah, yeah. Was it Joseph Smith? I know, I can't even remember the name of all the characters, like in the real life characters who set up a new religion and left and set out for, where is it? I was going to say Iowa. It's not Iowa. Where is it? Ohio? Where is that, I guess. The Mormons?
I don't know. I have no idea.
The LDS, the number plate of the car.
Oh, yeah, the LDS church.
LDS church, yeah.
That's so funny.
Our number plate is LDS because that's, what is it, Landkreis Dahme-Spreewald, which is where Juliana's parents live and where the car is registered. Her car is registered. So we've got an LDS car in our number plate.
Pretty funny. I didn't know about that, about Orson Scott Card. But I'm saying
even like abstracting all of that, even within the book itself, I kind of feel that kind of tension of part of me going yay and part of me going ugh.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I think this is a big part of this book, is this whole like good, bad, responsible, not responsible, kids, adults, intelligent, not intelligent, and this whole thing. So, and this plays out in the Ender's Shadow a lot more.
Well, let's get into that then.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a wrap up. I mean, we're wanting to concentrate on another three. I was going to say dramatic interpretations, but this is first of all a literary interpretation by the same author. Now, when this book came out, when I was going to read it for the first time, I was like, oh, what's this book? And I think the introduction of the book said, by Orson Scott Card says, what I was going to do was write this with another author, and we were going to set it up, and he was going to write within the Ender's Game world. And so we were going to write this story together, and I was writing my notes about Bean, who is this, one of the main characters, or the second main child character in Ender's Game, I'm guessing. You know, there's in the battle school and command school, there is Ender, there is Bean, and there's a few other of his companions, his officers, in a way, like
Petra.
I guess Petra is the other one as well. Yeah. So it's like, and he was like, I needed to write up some notes, and I wanted to like make it clear what the Ender's Game story was from Bean's point of view, because he was going to go on to become a major character in this new series, which was going to be written by this other author. So he started going, okay, and then this is what happened. And as he was writing, he was like, okay, not only are these notes not going to be for this other author, I'm going to write this other series, but also I'm going to write this book. You know, so it was never intended to be a solo book project by Orson Scott Card. But as he was working on he realized the basis for a new story or a new series of books set on Earth.
It happened to become a separate
book of its own. So what we actually get is the beginning of Bean's story from when he was a young child up through his time in battle school. Well, there's some stuff when he's like, where does he come from anyways? A slum down
in... from Rotterdam.
Is it Rotterdam?
He comes from, like, he is an orphan.
Yeah.
And he's a kid on the street. How are you?
Street urchin.
Whatever. And he is really, really, really small. So at the beginning, he's described by other people to look, he looks like 2 years old.
But he's actually
4 years
old.
Just imagine how a two-year-old kid looks like. Really, really small. And they can do things.
Yeah.
But they can't, I don't know. Certain things you cannot imagine by a two-year-old kid. And then it turns out he's already 4 or 6 or something.
Yeah.
He's older than he looks like. Yeah. But still, he's very, very tiny. And then... you get to see into his head. You get to see what he's thinking all the time, and because it's him telling his own story, and he is creating an army.
Yeah, on the streets, isn't he?
He's building up an army to survive because he can't get food. There are many, many kids on the street, obviously, and so he puts in place things. He's like pulling the strings in the background for them to become. An army of young kids.
Yeah, what's the name? There was the bad kid who they kind of intimidate.
Achilles. I don't know.
Something like that. I should actually look at it. I've got the Wikipedia page here as well. I should bring it up.
Here you can see it. Achilles.
Achilles.
Achilles. Oh, yeah. Well, in German, you pronounce it Achilles. Anyway,
So it's actually here pronounced Achille in the French pronunciation.
Okay.
Achille, not Achilles. So it's Achille.
Achille. Okay. Yeah. Well... Anyway, so, and he puts him to be like a defender of the small kids. And then...
Even though he's a bad guy.
Even though he knows Achille is a very bad person because he's a psychopath.
Yeah.
And at the beginning, Bean tells the leader of the kids.
Yeah.
She's called Poke. And she's the official leader, but Bean himself... makes her, like, influences her in doing stuff, like trying to get a bigger person to defend the kids.
Yeah.
And then they get a heel, because he has a problem with his one leg or something.
Yeah.
Like, like the name says. And
well, that's where his name comes from.
Yeah, obviously. And but then there's this point where they have it in the alleyway, and there are lots of little kids and this one big guy, and they put him down to the ground. And then Bean says, kill him.
Yeah.
You should kill him. Yeah. Because Bean knows that this guy is no good for.
Yeah, but the worst thing is that when I was reading this book, you know, I read it a while ago and I rated it quite lowly, kind of for one of these things, like in Ender's Game, there is that kind of artistry to the storytelling that, like, lots of things is important, lots of things do come back in.
Exactly.
Like, for example, in Ender's Game, there's that whole part where he's having dreams and he's communicating with the hive mind through the game, and you're like, what's going on? And you don't really understand it. It's only until the end you're like, oh, right, you know, like, it's done artfully, that stuff is set up, like, early on, which kind of has a function, is kind of mysterious. But when I was reading End of Shadow, it's like, kill him now, he's going to be trouble later. And then it was one of those times when he turns up in the battle school later, I was just like, oh, you should have killed me before. I should have stopped reading back then. You know, it was like one of those warnings that were coming up. I was like, he's going to come back
the
later.
The beginning of that book is so blatantly obvious in every single step.
Yeah, and this is what you were talking to me about before when you were reading this book. You were like, but it sets something up in one chapter and then pays it off in the next chapter.
Exactly. There's this one story, there's this one bit where there's this sister Carlotta. There's this Christian bit coming in.
Yeah.
She tries to find out where Bean comes from.
Yeah.
And shows
who the
parents are. And then she finds out, oh, he's a genetically engineered kid and made more intelligent. And then the eggs were stolen from a family. And then the eggs,
the embryos.
No, the Bean's father had a stepbrother, and that stepbrother wanted to take a revenge, and then so he took the eggs of his brother, and all this bit of story, really annoying. And
just not needed at all.
And then it turns out, and Bean in the battle school founds a friend called Nikolai. And then it turns out, they are brothers.
Yeah.
It turns out to be, like, on Earth, like,
they were
sister
Carlotta
finds out that they both are from the same family, and they are in fact brothers. And then one chapter later, you see Nikolai talking to a teacher, to Colonel Graf or something, saying, and the teacher's asking him why he's so close with Bean, and he's, we are like brothers.
Yeah, we look the same.
We feel like, he looks like me when I was older, and I feel attached to him like a brother. I always wanted a smaller brother. And he's like, oh, really? This is so badly written.
I know, it's one of those things where this is the thing where in all fiction, like, the author has a few things that he can get away with, or he or she can get away with at the beginning of a book, because then it's set up. It's like, there's a big coincidence, you know. So if there is a big coincidence, that has to set the story rolling, you know.
Yeah.
A big coincidence can set a story rolling. That's the kind of thing that happens in all of these what I was saying, like, you know, we watched When Harry Met Sally the other day, and it's about two people who have go on a car journey, and then 6 years later they meet up randomly and then don't meet again for another 6 years. It's one of those things that it's that, you know, you need at the beginning of a romantic comedy, you need that cute meet or meet cute where they get together in a way which is a little bit quirky, and there's one thing, you know, like if we want to go with You've Got Mail, which is, you know, he works in a bookshop, she works in a bookshop, and they're having an online relationship in real life, you know, and it's one of those things that that can be the basis of the beginning of a story. But when those coincidences happen 2/3 of the way into the book and start playing into as major plot points, or not even if they don't have to be major plot points, it's like, why bring along, like, at that point in the book, Ender has killed, like, when they're in the battle school, and we mentioned this before, Ender goes away to command school, leaving behind these guys in the battle school.
Yeah.
Ender has already taken out the main bad guy, which is Bozo. He's already defeated all of the armies and stuff.
Yeah.
But suddenly it's like, oh, now Bean doesn't have any bad guy to fight against. He doesn't have any enemy. Let's bring in Achilles back again. And then it's like, but, like, Was that intentional? Did Colonel Graff bring in... No, Colonel Graff went off with Ender off to battle school. It's like, that wasn't important anymore. They didn't need to suddenly bring in it. It feels like that coincidence. Oh, and this guy's your brother. And he really is. He doesn't just look like your brother, yeah. And you feel like your brother. You don't just have an adult understanding of relationships, that you can have a personal connection with someone without them being genetically your brother or, you know, actually being your brother. You can just strike up a friendship. And a friendship is more meaningful if it isn't family, if there isn't a big coincidence behind it. You just meet someone and you happen to get on well with them.
Yeah,
you know.
And the thing is with Nikolai and Bean is that, they are friends. And then this is not a massive big part of the story.
It's not needed.
I mean, of course, in the end, then they both turn back to Earth and they both go to their families and then they lie in their arms and cry. This is literally the end. And this is just so blatant. Like, this is just way too obvious. All the other things, you know, all the other Ender's battle and all the Bean is constructing the whole army and he's behind everything. This is very, like, subtle. You know,
it's not that subtle.
But it is more subtle, and all the other things are so much more obvious.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Achille, because he is also a very clever guy, and he is got chosen to be in battle school as well because of his good test results, and then he gets sent back to Earth after Bean proves him to be the murderer of seven people in a weird way. And then they send him back to Earth, and on way back to Earth, he escapes. Of
Who?
Course.
Achille. Yeah, okay.
He is escaping. And then, he's the ongoing part. He will come back in the future.
In Ender's...
In Bean's life.
Yeah, in the continuing...
Because Bean goes
back
to Earth.
Which, to be honest, I never read any more of those...
Yeah, but this is so obvious. You have something that will continue back on Earth.
Yeah, and that's what I say. It just feels so inartful. It's like, I'll get you next time.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. So, and the beginning of Ender's Shadow is, like, I did not enjoy at all. It was, like, really reading through Bean's story, and then...
The thing is, it's like backstory for a character who doesn't need backstory. Bean is fine. It's like, Bean's the short one. Let's just, like, if the story had started, like, with Ender needs to go to battle school. Or he's leaving school and he goes to battle school. Yeah. Or
I mean, I understand that this background is there for Bean because it explains a lot of his...
But the thing is, you don't need to see it then. Why couldn't it have been, like, later? Like, all of that stuff down on Earth.
Yeah.
Forget it. Just say, like, it could have been one of those things where, like, Colonel Graff comes down to him and say, hey, you, kid, you're really young, but we can see, like, we've seen from this surveillance, you know, people have kept an eye out for for young kids, even on the streets. We're looking everywhere. We need all kids to go into the mix for the training. We've seen you, and you've been controlling this group here, like that.
Yeah.
Or maybe it could have just started with, like, it could have started with that point with all the kids surrounding Achille, pinning him down, and him going, kill him, he's going to be trouble later. And then that kid never turning up, because it wouldn't have been important then. He would have just been a character that was needed for that moment, and then Colonel Graff comes in and say, hey, kid who's willing to kill other kids because, you know, you've already, even before you're at battle school, you've already learned Ender's lesson. Come here and let's go with it. There could have been...
I just wish there would have been more artistic things in that beginning. The beginning is just way too...
It was info dumpy and backstory-ish, and you don't need that much backstory.
And, like, I didn't enjoy it. And then the first thing when I actually enjoyed it was in part 4 of 6 parts, when Bean is working together with Ender. This is the part where it actually starts
being
fun again, because then it's back on the Ender's Game level.
Yeah.
All the bits beforehand, and of course also bits in between where Bean is just way too...
He's too clever.
He's too clever. And he's even more clever than all the teachers. And clever than Ender. And then he's turned to be the... I don't even know a word for that, what he is. He is the best of the best.
Yeah, he's
of the
super,
best.
He's one of those things, you know, he's like this superhero figure in a way that Ender, like, you can see Ender kind of, I know it's a weird thing, but you kind of Ender earns it throughout the book. You know, he goes through the pain.
Yes.
He goes through the self-doubt. He goes through all of those things in the book that he kind of, even though he's intelligent, he's actually not that intelligent. I mean, he's a tactical genius and he's got the right mindset, but you understand that he has to have that kind of weird, like, damaged personality,
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Edge of psychopathic, sociopathic kind of figure that you need to be to get through. And he has his doubts and he almost quits and these
yeah.
other things. Like I say, he has his flaws. Even if he doesn't fail, he has his flaws. And it's a kind of an interesting position that he's put in. Bean doesn't seem to earn any of his intelligence or earn any of experience. He just happens to know. Like, there's this one part which I find really weird is that in the first book, and this is one of the reasons why I didn't like this book again, why I only gave it like 1.5 stars. I mean, I on Goodreads I just put it down as a one star book or two
For me
star
it's
book.
Two, so.
But I put it down as a low book is because not only does it kind of it can't stand alone as a novel, even though I like it as a writing exercise. I find it interesting for someone to go back and revisit the same story from a different point of view. I like the idea of the book, but it concentrates on the wrong thing. It tries to fix continuity. It tries to fix physics. For example, in the battle school, they say, oh, in the center of the battle school is this empty sphere, the battle room or whatever it is. And inside is no gravity. On the outside is gravity, and then they go in, then there's no gravity. And Bean at one point in End of Shadow says, you think that, like, no, everybody else seems to think that the battle room has no gravity just because it's at the center of the space station, where it really doesn't have gravity because you've got some extra cool technology that hasn't been explained and is being kept secret from everyone, but I've worked it out. I know this gravity manipulation thing exists, and Colonel Graff is like, shh, we don't talk about that. And I'm like, don't point out four flaws in the physics of the space station that's being used as the battle station or the battle school in Ender's Game, because that just makes me think, well, what other, like, physical problems which are wrong with Ender's Game, which I didn't notice at the time. I didn't need to notice them.
No, it's not
like,
needed.
Why pick out problems with Ender's Game and then explain them away? Like, if you'd have just not told me that they were there. And this is the thing with Ringworld. You know, we were looking at Ringworld. That's going to be another book that we'll read in the future.
Yeah.
There was another book that Larry Niven wrote after that called Ringworld Engineers, in which they go back to Ringworld and it explains all the faults. It's like, oh, well, actually, Ringworld couldn't have worked in this way. So now this is the book about the engineers who have to keep Ringworld running. It looked like it would just keep running, but actually it would fall into the sun, or, you know, the weather wouldn't work and this wouldn't work and the oceans wouldn't work. It's like, and now let's investigate further into how this would actually work and the problems that weren't looked at in the first book. Now I'm going to look at them in this book. And it's like, don't bring my attention to those things. It's not needed to tell a good story. Science and technology can be not perfect and still work. I will allow some failures. I will allow some hand wavium powered technology things.
Yeah.
Like Ansible, faster than light communication. Great. Don't say anything more. Let's just go with that.
Yeah.
You know.
And the thing is with Ender Shadow, there are points where you're not quite sure if you like Ender as a person. Like, he has his weird things, but with Bean,
there's no personality. He's just amazing and super.
He has this weird kind of like, pretty much like almost Data kind of thing, like Data in Star Trek.
I understand that.
He has no idea how it feels to say goodbye to somebody and cry for them. And then he has no idea how it feels to be a friend.
But you can't have a whole book and then at the end he finds his humanity and cries with his parents. It's
suddenly then he finds his human touch. I don't know.
And up until the point you thought it was just bad characterization and bad writing.
Yes.
And then at the end it's like, oh no, he really is a human. Just didn't bother writing
and then
that
also
part.
Really I sometimes felt pity for the teachers because Bean treated the teachers in a really, really bad way, and they seemed to be the children compared to Bean, and Bean was just so superior in every way that I don't know, he was always had the trouble with other people calling him the small one, and
yeah,
but this was the only bit where they like
just his physical stature,
just his physical thing.
And it comes back to what we didn't like about the Vore game or Miles Vorkosigan.
It's like Miles Vorkosigan.
He doesn't earn any of his expertise.
He doesn't earn his intelligence. He was genetically engineered, so it's not even that he like.
Just... And his only thing wrong with him is a physical disability, is shortness and weakness, and then he just has to use his superior intellect. But his intellect is so far above everyone, including Enders. Yeah. He is just there.
Even in the last battle, Bean is.
He knows what's going on.
He knows what's going on, and in the end, he is controlling it. And he's like, this is also what in Ender's shadow. It suddenly turns out Ender didn't do it. It was Bean.
It was Bean all along.
It.
Yeah, he was the one who was giving suggestions and help to Ender all along.
Yes.
Like I say, it's not that the book doesn't work on its own right. It diminishes
Ender's game.
It diminishes Ender's game in a way that, like, often you'll say, oh, well, if a book comes out and a sequel comes out and the sequel's not very good, it doesn't diminish the original story. Or, you know, if the continuity changes, like Hyperion is a good one. You know, I read Hyperion, really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Fall of Hyperion. No, what is it? Hyperion. What was the next one?
Yeah, Fall of
Hyperion. Fall of Hyperion? No, it's... Yeah, or whatever the next one is.
Yeah.
Yeah, Fall of Hyperion. And it was so bad that I stopped reading it. I didn't get through to the end and just read. But Hyperion as a book, I can still read it and enjoy it. But now, but looking back at Ender's Game, I'm thinking after reading Ender's Shadow, you're like going, but what is the true story? You know, like, which is the true story? Because both of these were written about, like, by the same author. Like, does the author himself
know what's going on?
Yeah, does the author himself not have confidence in Ender? Because that's what it feels like. It's like, well, Ender was only a kid. He couldn't have done it by himself. Well, let's have two kids working together, but one of them didn't know it. For the purpose of his story, he didn't know it. And the purposes of this other story, he did know it. So anything else to say about this? Or should we just say that Ender's Shadow is an interesting writing experience and an interesting reading experience? But I don't think it's a recommended book in any way. And it didn't make me want to read on with the Ender's Shadow series or the Shadow series or anything like that.
No, not at all.
But in a way, I am glad I read it because I think it makes me a better...
It makes you appreciate Ender's Game
more. Yeah, it makes me appreciate Ender's Game more, even while at the same time thinking, like, Ender's Shadow diminishes Ender's Game and makes me enjoy Ender's Game less because it's like an author pointing out the flaws in his previous work.
Yeah.
Like, I don't mind it if it's, like, just a sequel which doesn't match up or the continuity doesn't match. Like, with Star Wars prequels, I don't mind that the Star Wars prequels don't match up and it kind of, like, and it diminishes it in a way. But it's, like, but when it's, like, going, oh, see this mistake in this book? In this book over here, since I'm like, well, actually, here's what really happened. It's not a mistake anymore. Ta-da! And I'm like, I never even realized that
but
mistake.
But this is the whole theme that goes through all the books. It is always this like play between the good and the bad thing, and the responsible and not responsible, and the you know, this is also like Ender's Game is good. Ender is good. But in Ender's Shadow, it turns out he's not that good.
Who, Ender's not that good?
Yeah.
He's not that intelligent.
Exactly.
He's not that clever.
So it's like
he's...
all this time that it shows you, it's like schizophrenic as Ender himself with his bad brother part and his good sister part.
Yeah.
So it's the whole time it just goes back and forth, back and forth, back and forth.
Yeah. So let's move on to the Ender's Game Alive. Ender's Game Alive. Let me switch it.
You didn't listen to this.
To be honest, I didn't get to the end. I only got about an hour and a half in.
Of how many hours?
Oh, let me bring it up. So here we go. Ender's Game. I'm just going to scroll down to... So we have revisions. Look. See, it says, in 1991, Card made several minor changes to reflect the political climate of the time, including the decline of the Soviet Union.
The big part in Bean's story is also the Russians.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is quite interesting. Now, maybe he should revise it again to bring the Russians back into it. So it says, audio play. Ender's Game Alive, the full cast audio play is an audio drama written by Orson Scott Card based on the Ender's Game novel. At over 7 hours in length, it's a retelling of Ender's Game, hints at storylines from Teacher's Pest, The Polish Boy, The Gold Bug, which I don't know any of them, Ender's Shadow. So it kind of brings in these other things, you know, in Speaker for the Dead, and, you know, it gives new insights into the beginning of Ender's philotic connection with the Hive Queen, but I didn't get that part, unfortunately, because it just wasn't very good. It started off in this really interesting way, which I thought was really, I was expecting, like, sure, it's a full cast audio play, but this is, it's just based purely on dialogue between characters.
Yeah.
And I thought there might be a narrator in there. No narrator.
The whole story has to be transported by people talking
about the story. And it started off really interesting because Ender isn't in, he's not in it for like the first 20 minutes or something like that. It's like people, they, you know, they come down and have a conversation with his parents, which is actually quite sweet. It's quite a sweet beginning. They're saying, oh, you've already got two kids, but we want to have a third one. We really, really want you to have a third one. Are you going to do it? And it was a quite, you know, I don't remember reading that in Ender's Game, or the scene is really well done, let me put it that way.
Yeah.
And then it's like a conversation between the, you know, what was it, Graf, and what was the other, the psychologist up there.
Psychologist, yeah.
Let me have a look at the, in the thing. So you've got Colonel Graf, and then Major Gwen Anderson, which is the name of the character in the movie, anyway, so let's just say it's her. So you got, like, the, because it's, again, played by a female, so it's the two, like, the Graf and the psychologist talking to each other about Ender, like, oh, we're going to remove the thing in his brain, and we're going to do this, and the first part of the book, Ender doesn't say anything, and it's just, like, it's just conversations between adults about Ender.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, this would be great if we go through the whole book like this. This is going to be an amazing retelling, because it's not from this point of view, it's not from Bean's point of view, it's from the adults.
Outside.
It's from the adults' point of view. And you get that in Ender's Game. You get those, you know, the bits at the beginning of the chapters where they're talking to each other.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, great. A whole audio play full of professional adult actors doing, like, retelling the story from the adult's point of view. And I was like, yeah, great, let's go for it. And then after about 20-30 minutes, Ender turns up and we start seeing stuff from his point of view, and the acting doesn't hold up, there's no narration, it's just dry. And in the end, like I say, it just becomes a retelling of, and we just watched the movie as well, so I already knew the story was still fresh in my mind, and it seems to be influenced a bit by the movie. And like I say, it's like a retelling, bringing in lots of influences from these other books. I recognize some of them, but in the end, just not very good, unfortunately. And that's why I only got about an hour and a half into it, because I really like the full cast audio kind of things, which might be a trade name or a trademark thing, where you get different actors reading out the different character voices in the book.
Yeah.
So you don't have to have he said, she said, all that
yeah.
kind of stuff. You just get that. Or like an audio drama where there's like sound effects and you hear stuff going on, like in the battle, it's like the battle is on, and there's like this, yeah. But it wasn't that, it was just really dry, just people talking at each other about stuff, which was, and then everything had to be on the surface because there was no way to describe, like, and that person looked at this person, they gave them a sly look, or even in the movie where two characters will look at each other with a meaningful look,
yeah.
That meaningful look had to be put into the dialogue. It wasn't even put into
really?
The voice. But that's the thing, the scene at the beginning between the parents, there was some of that kind of good acting between those two characters, and I was like, oh, that's really interesting, they're bringing stuff out with the tone of voice. And then as it went on, all of that just fell away, and it was just like, what do you think? I think this. Well, I think we should do this because of this, 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 and this, and this is my motivation, and I think Ender will do it this way. Why do you think that? Because he did that, and that. Like, it's like in the book, we just see Ender doing those things.
Yes.
And so I can't recommend that. Even though I spent an Audible credit on it, I was really looking forward to, like, again, like a different retelling. But that's why we do the Science Fiction Book Review podcast, to warn you about these different retellings. Again, I didn't get far enough into it to know any story differences between or like new insights. Like, it says a new insight here, and we see this bit here, and we'll learn this different thing here, and it brings in these plot elements from these other books, from these other series, and the later Ender series, you know. So, yeah. That's all I have to say about that. Not very much. We move on to the movie, because this is the thing that I'm actually quite interested to talk about here.
True.
Overall, You start off, because I've just talked a lot about that audio drama.
The movie.
Yeah, the Ender's Game movie came out last year, 2013.
Yeah, we watched it. And it was supposed to be like, because everyone knew in advance, oh, it will have Harrison Ford in it. And everyone was really like, yay, Harrison Ford, Colonel Graf.
Did you not like Harrison Ford in it? Is that what you're setting up to be? You're setting up disappointment there? Or what you're setting up?
Slight disappointment, because he wasn't like really a big part. Like,
well, I thought he did quite a good job.
He did a good job.
He was sleepwalking through it. I mean, it was just a paycheck.
Yeah, exactly.
For him.
This is what it looked like. It wasn't Harrison Ford really like acting, like having fun acting.
Yeah.
And I don't think that...
He doesn't...
What is it?
Asa Butterfield.
Asa Butterfield. What a fun name. That he is just...
He's not very good.
I don't think he's... He did a good job in acting there.
The only thing that we saw him in before was... Which was actually another movie with him and Ben Kingsley in. Sir Ben Kingsley. We saw Hugo, the movie set in the train station in Paris. And we got like 25 minutes into that. Neither of us had smiled once. We didn't know what the story was about. And we just turned it off. And it's like, yeah, this is great. And I guess if we were watching it in 3D, all those big swooping establishing shots of Paris would be interesting. But we don't need 3 establishing shots in a row of Paris and a train station.
And pipes.
And pipes.
And like, pipes.
And pipes and more pipes and more someone going around and then a thing with a guy and a policeman and a guard and a thing and another thing. And it just went on and like half an hour in or something, which like, we still don't know what this movie is about. Apparently it's about the birth of cinema. And of course, all that. Yeah. You know, Ben Kingsley's character, he was one of the, what was his name? The guy who did the famous picture of the man in the moon, where the rocket hits the moon, it's sticking in the eye of the moon and stuff like that. He was a pioneer of that. Early movies. But again, I only know that because someone told me afterwards.
Everything of the beginning didn't make any sense.
No, it made sense. It was just boring and there was no story and nothing was happening.
Anyway, I don't think that Asa Butterfield did...
Oh yeah, that's what I was going
to
say.
The thing is, Ender's character is really, really complex and is really difficult to do. And
he just looked upset and angry all the time.
Yes. His look in his eyes was just all the time really weird. And I really enjoyed the special effects when they practiced in the battle school and then the end when they had the big battle, how the ships
did like
this. Oh,
it looked great, I think.
How the ships like did the maneuver that they did in battle school with people inside and other ships around them. And
yeah, I thought that was actually a little... It's one of those weird things, the balance of the movie, it felt to me they were trying to cram in a little bit too much of the book.
Yes.
I think it could have been cleared up a bit and it would have given them more time. I wanted to see more time in the battle school, but the movie really came into its own when he got to the command school. In that like last third section was where it really picked up. But at the beginning of the movie, like, we were really struggling. Like, half an hour into the movie, we were looking at each other and groaning, weren't we?
Yeah.
Because at the beginning, it's like, oh, Ender is a third. And all of that stuff, we didn't know. That is not needed for the movie at all. We don't need to know that Ender is a third. We need to know...
Because you can't really explain it in this movie.
In the movie, it was just... And they're going, eh, you're a third. And it's like, well, they had that line, and then they had to explain it beforehand and stuff. And it felt so often that stuff was being explained in reverse in the movie. And that happened quite a few times where someone will do something and then a character was like at the end. We know, having read the book, that Ender thinks that Maser Rackham is the one who is controlling the formic forces in the computer simulations that actually turned out to be real, as we were talking about before. In the movie, it's only after he destroys all the formic's homeworld and gets rid of all of them and does all of that. It's only after all of that happens when he says, but Maser Rackham, you're the one who was controlling these forces. It wasn't real. You were the one who was controlling it. And I was like, wouldn't it have been better to set that up beforehand? If Maser Rackham, he could have just done a simple line. It's like, I'm going to be controlling the enemy forces up in this room up here. You've got to fight against me. You've got to prove that you're a better leader than me.
Yeah.
If that would have been setting it up in advance. But all the time, it felt like these things in the movie were being explained in reverse, which didn't need to be explained.
Yeah.
And there was another part. What was it? It was him being a third and... There was another thing in the book which I was like, why even introduce that idea? I can't remember there was something actually in the battles. Oh yeah, it was at the beginning they take this web out of his brain.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was thinking, that's really, I mean, I know it's in the book. They take this, was it the thread or whatever they call it? I can't remember what they call it.
In the first school they have that too.
But then it was confusing because he was in a school. And then he was told he was being taken out of the school, and then they removed the brain thing, and then he gets sent to another school, and then out to another school. So it's like, oh, you're leaving school, but going to battle school, and then you go to command school. It would have been much better if they'd have started off, hey, kid, you're going up to battle school, and start it there.
Yes.
Don't talk about the thing that they have in his brain so they know what he's thinking, because later on, when he's interacting with the game... It knows what he's thinking and it's interacting with his mind. And I was thinking, well, how does it interact with his mind and his thoughts when he had the thing that they could tell what he was thinking taken out? And in the book, it's explained, and I know because it isn't about that. You know, it's more you know, it's again, it's just more artistically, artfully done. And I do think that in the book, the whole concept of the third and this brain thing that they have, just take it out and it would have been a much better movie.
Yeah, I think that was the big problem with that movie. The screenplay writing thing just wasn't good enough. They tried too hard, I think.
Yeah.
They tried to put too much information from the book into it.
Yeah.
And that made it then partly not a good movie, because in movies you need different things than in books.
Yeah, but... And then also there was that part in when they got into the battle school, into the battle sphere, not what they call it, the battle chamber.
Yeah.
Battle room, I guess.
Battle room. Yeah.
So they go into the battle room, and instead of learning stuff by going, they go out and it's just like lambs to the slaughter. They go out and there's a team already in there, and it's like, psh, psh, and they all get stiff and float away being stiff. And they're like, oh, well, I guess if you get shot, we get stiff. But in the movie, it's like, oh, Ender, Bean is like, Ender, shoot my leg. Oh, I shot my leg. It's tingly and it's all stiff. Now you shoot me. Yeah. Wee. Oh, it's all like, it was like these kids discovering something in a way which was like, I was watching going, are we meant to be impressed by these special effects? Because the special effects, I mean, they look pretty, but at that point, it was a little bit, you know, we were concentrating, they were saying, hey, look at my legs now. And that was only setting up for a battle that was coming up anyway. Like, why do all that special effects to show us kids discovering stuff by explaining it to each other and to us? Why not just show us it happening?
Also, the big thing that is missing in the film, because they don't have enough time, of course, to show stuff like that. There's only one battle in battle room, I think.
Yeah, and it's the final battle where he goes.
The final battle, and also you don't see any of the kids learning stuff. You don't see any of the kids developing things. You don't see any of the kids growing together.
You just see the result of it when they're already a team.
You always just see the results, and I don't remember. The thing is, I only remember pretty much just the end of it, where it just all comes finally together.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. We were really struggling all the way through. We were going, oh, this isn't a very good movie. This is really disappointing. Until Ender leaves the battle school.
Yeah.
Oh, no, there's one other thing that I wanted to say, is that they kind of get away with Ender killing Bozo.
Yeah.
By him doing it by accident, he pushes him over and then he falls over and cracks his skull off the edge of the shower block.
Exactly.
And it's like, oh, he killed him, but he killed him back. And that was another one of those things. Oh, he killed him by accident. He didn't mean to do it, which actually worked okay in the movie, but it did once again feel like it is
pulling
his punch.
It's very much a movie thing, because they wanted it to make that kids also can go into it to watch it. But the thing is, this is the main bit in the book, is that he's punching him to death.
Yes.
It's such a cruel thing.
Yeah.
And of course...
He needed to take out the threat so he never faces it again, you know. Yes,
and that is the thing.
Although
in the book,
he doesn't know he's killed the kid. I mean, he's not told he killed the kid. He only finds out for sure at the end of the book, doesn't he?
Yeah, but he punches him in the face.
Yeah.
And to punch someone with your fist in the face, you have to have some certain kind of aggressive...
What are you talking about? I punched someone in the face
last year. I never punched anyone in the face. I wouldn't do that. But
you're a woman.
What? Come on. Anyway, so...
yeah, but in the movie, they kind of just make him push him and it falls over.
And they try to make it too nice. And then, of course, the whole story of Ender's Game is that kids... Well, as I said, the kids' responsible thing just fades away, and they try too hard to put everything into the story of the movie, and then they leave out too much because.
But actually, I quite like the setup with Valentine and Peter, that they didn't do. You know, in the book, there's that whole like political angle that they didn't even try to put any of that in. Which
is
great.
That would have been way too much.
Yeah, but then they were like, oh, Ender, we need someone who isn't as psychopathic as Peter and is has the kindness of one and the loving, like the understanding of one and the other, you know. And I quite like that, you know, that play between them, that you just see these two characters and then Peter disappears. Valentine comes back for a little bit, that she has to be some kind of motivating factor in his life later on. But there was another thing, which, like I say, why concentrate on the brain thing? Why concentrate on the third thing? And there was another thing, was like, why concentrate on the game that he's playing with the... there was a giant and he was a mouse and he took out the giant. You know, there was all of that thing. And I was like, wow, they're spending a lot of time on that. That's not really important. However, let me get onto this main point. But when they get to the command school, You know, I think Ben Kingsley didn't do a very good job and there was other stuff going on. But suddenly the movie comes together and now it's no longer a kid's, like, hokey kids movie. Hey, we're in space, we're flying around, we're battling. Suddenly it becomes, like, the tone clicked with me and you as well, I think. And yeah. Suddenly we were, like, really invested in the character and in the story in a way which really surprised me, considering the first half of the movie, I just wasn't emotionally or intellectually or there was just no stimulation there at all. Yeah. Suddenly halfway through, something just changed tonally, and when they're actually starting fighting the Formics, you know, in the, and there's the big simulation room and he's doing yeah. the he's doing the Minority Report kind of zooming through zooming, the menus yeah. and he's controlling it and he's got all his friends around him and they're going there and Mazer, Rackham and Graf are looking down at him and you know all this other kind of stuff going on. Suddenly at that point it all comes together and I realize, oh, they don't, the twist isn't, and this is the clever thing about the movie, the twist isn't the twist. You know, the big twist that we're saying that, oh, it all happens to be real. It's kind of set up. It's like the movie makers were clever enough to know that that twist couldn't sustain the end of the movie. That couldn't be the big climactic moment.
Yes, and so they made a different thing,
yeah,
the big thing.
What I thought would be the big climactic moment is Ender defeats the Formics homeworld, destroys it with the molecular, what is it, the molecular disruptor device. Doctor, what was it, the MD...
Doctor thing.
Yeah, MD, yeah. The MD, molecular disruptor weapon thing, beam weapon, that they have to, you know, has to charge up and fire and the stuff like that. And that was really good. And you think, well, that, in the book, that's the climax of the book where that big is, that's revealed, and then everything after that is just sort of like the fallout. But in the movie, they made the fallout the climax. The actual climax was a really important character moment where Ender discovers that it's not been a game all along. And then he goes out right away. It's not like something that happens later. He goes out right away almost, isn't it? And he discovers the queen egg. And suddenly that sequence is actually the climactic sequence. And it was done in a way which actually I think is better than in the book. Because in the book, you lead up to that point and then you're like, oh, and here's the twist. Twist revealed. And then you go, oh. And then in that, I always feel like in the book, the stuff that happens after that is kind of like, oh, and he was upset about it and he did this and he found the queen and Peter sent him this message and he wrote a book and all that, you know, that kind of stuff. It feels kind of like tacked on. It's like, you know, when
so it
Orson
feels
Scott...
like he has to put something on the back to continue the story.
Yeah, because you can't just end, oh, that's that. And him going, oh, you've committed genocide, there's nobody there anymore, you've wiped out this whole entire alien species, and it was all a mistake all along because they couldn't, you know, they didn't think humans were intelligent because we didn't have a hive mind, and we thought they weren't intelligent because they had a hive mind. You know, it's that whole kind of misunderstanding thing there. It's kind of like in the book, it feels like an explanation afterwards, whereas in the movie, that becomes the climactic scene, Ender going off and finding the queen and all the stuff that happens there. I don't actually remember exactly how it happens. I don't need to explain it, but I was really surprised how it really impacted me. The movie impacted me in a way that the book didn't. And it kind of explains it. You know what I was saying before about like the weird political lack of responsibility, violent children, you know, little Hitler genocide apologist kind of thing going on in the book. The politics and all of that in the movie actually sat way nicer for me. You know, I actually was a lot more, I enjoyed it a lot more. I think the politics of the movie is different enough from the book to be a different thing. Even though, like I say, the first half I thought was a lot of trouble. There's only like three adults in the whole movie and then it's all kids and we're like, wait, where are all the adults? They're running around and there's only ever three adults. Like even in the background of Battle School, there's only ever three adults. You're like, there must be more adults than this.
Yeah.
And even when they get to command school, they bring the adults with them and introduce Ben Kingsley and then there's still only three adults.
Yeah.
And who was that? What was the character? Who was the guard command guy? Was it
Sergeant? Sergeant Dapp, wasn't it?
Oh yeah, Sergeant Dapp. And
in the movie, he was the big.
It was like this big teddy
nice guy,
and he was playing. They got like this really big roly poly teddy bear character who looks so nice and totally unthreatening, and got him to shout at kids. And I was like, wow, he is the least threatening drill sergeant. You know, you really want that, like, yeah, we'll do this. You want to be scared of the drill sergeant. But I was never convinced by his shouting. Like, and then he suddenly turns around and you see his human side. And he's very good at the human side because the guy's a big teddy bear.
Yeah.
And yeah, and these other characters, like I say, the first half of the Ender's Game movie really didn't convince me. The second half, I was with it all the way, and it touched me like emotionally and stimulated me intellectually and was impressive. Oh, that's what I said. At the beginning, I was like, why are they concentrating on this game? Like with the, you know, this mind game that he plays.
Yeah.
And it turns out that was the Ender's Game that was more important in the movie. That yeah. mind game where he saw his sister and there was a thing in there and he didn't know what he was looking at. And then all of that big reveal at the end was way better than in the book, I think.
Yes. It was totally different.
Even though I think overall the movie is flawed in so many other ways that I don't think it's a great movie. I'm not even sure if it's a good movie, but the second half was really good for me personally. Yes. I really enjoyed it. Yes. The second half,
it was really good. Also, the thing in the movie is missing that they run around in the battleships, battle schools, command schools. They run around naked so often
in the book.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, it's very homoerotic. The kids, you know, oh, and now I'm going to have a fight naked in the shower. People talk about this and say, wait a second, this guy is against gays and homosexuals and gay marriage, and this is like the most homoerotic stuff ever. Two kids fighting in the shower. Naked in the shower with a towel around the waist. There is a little bit of that in the movie, but it, generally everyone's got the costumes on, you're right.
Yeah.
And thankfully there's no... They didn't put a love story in there for Ender. Oh, also what I liked more about the movie is that he's not like a six-year-old going into battle school. He's obviously like 12, 13, 14 years old, and by the end of it, he's only like a year older or something, because of course they can't wait for the kids to grow up.
Yeah, he looks like 10 or 12.
Yeah,
but, not 13 or 14.
Yeah, but whatever. I can't tell how old kids are when they're that young, you know. It's difficult. So, that's all. I think all I have to say about the movie. So let's run it down. The book, definitely read it. It's really interesting. Ender's Shadow, don't bother reading it. Just take our word for it. It's not worth reading. But quite a lot of people, of course, if you're going to continue on with the Ender's Shadow series, if you intend to read it, of course, start there. But I don't think it adds a lot to the story, and I think it just takes it away. And I don't think Bean is a good enough character to tell that story.
Bean is just way too
well, again, I would have liked, like I say, I was really pleased. That's what I thought I was getting from the Ender's Game Alive. I thought I was going to get it from the adult's point of view. I'd have loved to have seen, like, what the adults were doing and, like stories from the front, like the battlefront, like what was it like being in a spaceship knowing that a kid was controlling, or did you even know that? Maybe there's rumors going around the fleet saying, do you know our commander's only 15 years old or something?
No, and then I was thinking, how do they do it in the Ender's Shadow as well? Like, they are transferred directly into the ships, but then are their voices changed, or do you hear like a 10-year-old?
Well,
saying,
I think they're doing.
You have to do this and this.
No, I think they're controlling it. Like, they're sending commands via the console inputs. I don't think.
No,
they're
getting... they are talking.
Oh, are they?
Yes. Oh, that is the thing.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying. In the movie, I think it works better because they're obviously
the on-screen touchy.
And also
thingies.
That's another thing that the movie does quite well. You understand that people are dying, really dying in the battle, but you've got all those cool drones, those little buzzing things that are flying around and protecting. Yeah. And I actually really like the imagery. And also I like the fact that every single one of those drones that gets killed, I'm not thinking, oh, someone's died there. Oh, someone's died there. Oh, so, because in the movie, you understand that people are really dying in the battle, but they're on like the command ships and the these other ones. It's like, yeah, we've got to get that part over there.
Yeah. Yeah, so, there are some questions that are not really answered.
But that's what I thought. I mean, that's the kind of thing that I thought the Ender's Game Alive would be, is to have it all from the adult's point of view. And I think that's still an interesting story to tell. Like, never show the kids on screen. Like, a movie that's the story of Ender's Game, but always told from the point of view with the people who interact at, like, one step removed, you know? Yeah. Like, what do Graf's bosses think? What's going on here? How does all of that politicking work? That would be interesting. So, Ender's Game Alive, don't bother with it. Ender's Game, watch the movie, and if you're not enjoying the first half, like, if you're going, oh, this is a stupid kids' movie, which isn't really a kids' movie because it's a bit too violent and a bit too boring to be a kids' movie, stick with it, because the second half of that movie I do think is worth it, and it does some interesting stuff. So, recommend the original book and the movie. Ender's Shadow, probably not. Ender's Game Alive, not. And again, we only wanted to talk about this. We were not going to talk about continuing the series onwards with Speaker for the Dead, but I think we should. You'll probably find Speaker for the Dead in German.
We'll check it out.
We'll do it later this year sometime, maybe. Once we finish the...
Once you finish all the other thousands of books that I need to read. And
no, we'll finish off the culture... Once we finish off the culture series, we'll check out Speaker for the Dead, yeah?
Okay.
And after we've done Ringworld as well, which is a book that we bought yesterday. So, you can check out Ender's Game, probably as an audiobook. So go to audibletrial.com/SFBRP and start a free trial. You should check that out. I don't have anything more to say. 200,000 audiobooks that you can pick one of them for free when you start a free trial. That also helps support our reading habits. We spent €3 on a paper copy of Ringworld
in
German for Juliana yesterday. Because
there's no ebook, once again.
So help mine and Juliana's reading things by going to... audibletrial.com/SFBRP and starting a free trial. You get a free book and you help support us. And if you want to continue on the trial, that's what we did. Both of us did anyway. We both have Audible subscriptions.
Yeah.
So Juliana's got a gold subscription. I've got a platinum. I get 2 books a month. Juliana gets 1 book a month.
And I'm still like listening to Pandora Star.
Yeah,
it goes on and on
by Peter Hamilton.
But it's really good.
You really enjoy that one. We will not be reviewing that because there's no way I'm going to read that again at the moment. I've got so much other stuff to read.
Obviously, it's like a huge book.
Huge book. What else? Yeah, email me, luke@juggler.net. If you enjoyed this episode, also especially if you enjoyed our previous episode that we did together, what was the book that we read? The 1930s book. I don't have the list up
Peacock.
Here. Yeah, Alexander Peacock's. Let me bring it up here. What is it called? And also go to sfbrp.com. I forgot to mention. I was going to mention this at the beginning of the episode. But if you go to sfbrp.com and you click on the episode lists link, the list can now be sorted in different ways, which is very easy. So you can click on the top of the things. It was We Have Seen Better Days. So if you enjoyed our episode 226 that we released at the beginning of April, We Have Seen Better Days, please email us about that. If you enjoyed that episode or if you got anything to ask, any questions about that, that would be really great. And what else do I normally say? Follow me on Twitter. I'm @LukeBurge. Also, get onto goodreads.com and become our friend on goodreads.com. And then we can also see what you think of books like Ender's Shadow, which has got a 3.7 average by Friend Reviews on Nicholas thinks it's 3 stars. Two stars. Brian, 3 stars. Michael, 3 stars. Troy G rated it 3 stars. So lots of people think it's about a 3-star book. Oh, lots of people rated it 5 stars, actually. But I put it down as like a 1 to 2 star book, I think, overall.
Yeah, for me, it's a 2-star book as well because I enjoyed the end, but only the end.
Anyway, become my friend on Goodreads. Also, go across SFBRP listener group on Goodreads. That's the way to interact with me publicly. You can send me an email. I reply to every emails, but to interact publicly with and chat to other SFBRP listeners, I outsource the community functions of the SFBRP to goodreads.com, which I think is the best way to do it. What else do I normally say at the end of the podcast? I think that's it.
That's it.
What's the next book that we're going to do? Oh, tomorrow we're going to do an SFF audio podcast about the H.G. Wells' When the Sleeper Awakes.
Oh, When the Sleeper Wakes.
The Sleeper Awakes. Or When the Sleeper Wakes. Yeah. The Sleeper Awakes. There's 2 versions of the same book, both written by H.G. Wells. We read one each. We're going to talk to Jesse about that. I will stick that here in the SFBRP feed for fans of Juliana and me. I'll stick that in the feed in the coming days. Otherwise, what else? That's about it, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it.
We'll see you later. Catch you later and say goodbye.
Goodbye.
And we'll catch you next time. Well, I've forgotten that I've got a signature end to this podcast. See you next time. Catch you later. See you next time. That's it. Bye. Bye. I messed up the end.
Totally.